Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July the 29th, 1999. And this afternoon in Koinonia Fireside Room is John Rose Sales' session called The Enlightenment is Dead and Nature Kindled It, number 99-1. Let's listen in.
John Rosales. I'm a PhD student in urban and public affairs at the University of Delaware. And I do have some connections to Holden. I'll just talk to you the secrets over here. And I've always heard about this place, and I really appreciate Holden letting me do this, because I'm working on my dissertation now and I'm stuck. I've deconstructed the technological and the economic systems the way I think they should be deconstructed, but I can't come up with an alternative. I'm thinking about some things, and if I have time, I'll get to those, but I'd like to really explain where I'm at to you and then have you give me some feedback, either about the deconstruction process that I've come up with or some of your own ideas that you have. So this is the outline I have so far of my dissertation. I don't know if you can read this or not. Can you see it back there? Is that fine? And the title is a working title. I'm not stuck on that. The Enlightenment is Dead and Nature Killed It. It's not entirely correct, but it got some people here anyway. Part one is the deconstruction of the techno-economic imperative. I want to look at our technological system and our economic system and explain some of the underlying logic to both of those, and then lead up to a point somewhere down here where I explain that we are at an impasse. I'll reveal some of the contradictions and say we are at an impasse. Now what do we do? And that's where we need to look at some alternatives. So what I'd like to do today is just briefly hit the high points of these six chapters here, 2, 3, 4, 5 through 6, and hopefully convey to you where I think we are at. And then these chapters down here are the ones I'm working on, the one I want to get feedback on. So with that, I'd like to briefly touch on chapter 2. Chapter 1 is just an introduction, so I'll write that last. For now, let's just start with chapter 2. And I have written part of chapter 2 already, so I'd like to just quickly read that to you and then skip on to 3 and 4 and explain efficiency and growth. So I'd like to start about 500 years ago. And 500 years ago, life questions deep and ordinary were answered by the church. The answers were definitive, although sometimes they were debated within the church. The church had scriptures, tradition, momentum to guide their proclamations. It was an era of full authority, but it did not last. The 15th century ushered in an era of humanism. As a reaction to the lack of dignity and respect for human power and ability, the Renaissance began. You may remember Descartes saying, "I think, therefore I am." Through reason and objectivity, humanity gained the ability to control the world or nature, to know its secrets, to master its ways, and satisfy our desires. And at this time, Sir Francis Bacon said or wrote, "If we know how nature works, let's make it work for us." Everything in nature could be explained mechanically with math as its language. These are the ideas of Newton. So I'm going pretty fast here. So I'm just going to hit the high points here. Science became the legitimizing agent as Europeans turned inward to find knowledge. No longer was it divine. By the way, I should have said that at the beginning. This is Western history and Western civilization. I'm referring to Western civilization. Science offered a way out, a way of explaining, and it also gutted the authority of the church. The appeal of science was its rationality and objectivity realized through reason. Now, envious of the physical sciences, the social sciences began applying the same principles. 500 years ago, social philosophers debated the possibility of civilization itself. Now a system guided by science would be the last one, an everlasting system. It would be a system where social dialectics were identified and ironed out. Objectivity, rationality, and reason lay in the human mind. They could be controlled. They are a powerful stimulant for the faith in humankind. They reaffirmed the potential of human beings, that the future lie in our head, is in our head. It was a complete reversal and ushered in an era of humanism. Now, humanism is an important point here. Humanism was ushered in the 15th century and continues to be the dominant paradigm. With humanity's ability to use language and writing to pass on knowledge, social progress took direction. As time moves forward, knowledge was multiplied. It was thought that knowledge was multiplied. The theory of evolution deeply affected the social sciences, progressing towards something better, from infancy to maturity, linear improvement. Humans began to see themselves as advancing gradually toward a better state. It was at this time that Star Trek was conceived, the glories of Star Trek and advancing toward this sort of utopian arrangement. Movement forward, just forward in time, became progress. The past then was necessarily worse than the future. Now this Enlightenment arrangement propelled forward our technological and our economic systems. So that is basically, what I just covered there is basically chapter two. I covered it fairly quickly, but what I'd like to get on to is chapters 3 and 4, where we look at efficiency and growth as the imperatives for our technological and our economic systems. Moving on to chapter 3, the industrialists, through technology, made rationality, objectivity, and reason tangible. Technology was the potential of science. It made science visual, oral, central. It gave life to science. Technology encompassed humanity's dreams and aspirations. It represents optimistic promise of deliverance and salvation through science. So technology became the mode of social progress. It allows labor to be more productive, takes over routine tasks, relieves men of stress and the monotony of life, and does what humans cannot. Humanity accepted the glories of technology in their entirety. And efficiency, this is another key point, efficiency became the mode of technological advancement. Tried to become more efficient with technology. And you can see this all over. We're still trying to do this. For example, I'm not just talking about technological efficiency, where you produce more with the same amount of inputs, but also management, doing things in a more efficient manner. I'm working here as a waitress, and it seems like every day we're trying to lay out the plates, clean up after dinner in the most efficient manner. You know, we try to do things in the most efficient manner. Well, that happens on a social scale, too, and global scale. In fact, management now is moving into new areas. For example, the Kyoto Protocol, which looks at the climate change, and it had the Climate Change Convention attached to it, seeks to manage the carbon cycle. So something that nature used to just manage by itself. Now human beings are looking to manage that by allotting X amount of pollution rights, so to speak, for each country. So, and also the market. The market is seen as the vehicle for efficiency, and the market, as we all know, is penetrating everywhere. We just saw a play last week. I can't remember the name of it. Do you remember?
Baby Dancing?
Yeah, about the commodification of life. It was about adoption. And the rationality behind a lot of this I'm suggesting here is efficiency. The ideas I'd like to use in my dissertation come from Jocko Lule. Has anybody heard of Jocko Lule?
Sorry, what's his last name?
That's E-L-L-U-L.
Yeah.
Okay, good. I hope you can read this. But he wrote a book in 1954 called The Technological Society. And basically, he looks at this strive for efficiency, and as it takes over more and more of the processes within a society. And the term he uses is technique. And he defines technique as the standardized means to achieve a predetermined end. It's finding the best way. And I'll get back to this quote right here in a second. But he lays out the dimensions for technique as we strive for efficiency and how pervasive they are in society. So I'd like to quickly just read through these and lead up to my point on how pervasive this efficiency and technological imperative is. First dimension is automatism. as seeking the one best way, as we do as Waitrack. It's formulaic. They're predetermined answers chosen by the technique, not humans. Have any of you taken a statistics course or a test? Statistics is everywhere now. And it's really not, if you take a test, it's really not about problem solving. It's about testing you if you know how to use the technique. So the technique already predetermines the answers. The cost-benefit analysis is the same way. The technique is better than the human beings. It determines the outcomes. It's an arithmetic process that can be passed on all over globally. Between disciplines, I don't know what you're in, but I just talked to a cancer researcher that took the same statistics courses as I did in the social sciences, and it's everywhere. Probably in theology at the University of Chicago, you may have to take statistics, I'm not sure. Efficiency is a standard. Human records record, or humans are relegated to recording effects and results. And a quote I pulled out of there is, technique thus reveals itself once destroying a creator and no one wishes or is able to master it. The second dimension that Allul comes up with for technique is self-augmentation. Technological improvements are irreversible and inherited. It's geometric. Technical problems call for technical solutions. There's a typo in there. And anything and everything which is technique is able to produce is produced and accepted by the consumer. And some of you may be feeling this in our society. It seems like there's so many products out there that are produced just simply because they are produced, and then they're pushed onto us with marketing. And as consumers in a technological society, we seem to accept them. Monism is the third dimension. Technique is a civilization unto itself. What you get as a whole is the whole. Humans have used technique for what it was intended. There is no other way. And since it was possible, it was necessary. There are three other dimensions to technique that he describes in his book, and let me just quickly go over these. The necessity of linking together. It's finding the one best way. Well, that's the first one. Technique is not singular, it's an ensemble. Capability leads to the necessity to act. It is ability determined. He argues in the book that the atomic bomb, for example, had to be produced because we had the knowledge. And that's kind of a scary thought. And if you think about biotechnology, it's kind of taking us there now too, especially with cloning. Dr. Seed, his last name is Seed, he has vowed to clone a human, even though he's been exiled now from the United States. So if we have the knowledge, it seems that it has to be made. Technique is the code between sectors. You can imagine a theologian and, let's say, a chemist talking to each other and asking if they operate within a Windows environment. You know, that's the commonality between them, is technique. Technique, Windows, the operating system, computer operating system. Technique links with everything. It pulls on the heart, the mind, education, police, military, all in. So Allul in his book says that technique links all these separate sectors together. Technique collapses non-technical culture. Globalization culture is technique, not necessarily Americana. There is sort of one package of economic development that is being exported worldwide now by the World Bank and the IMF. And some people call it the Washington Consensus. And that is to open up to trade, open up to capital formation, and get your financial get your financial system in order. This is spread everywhere. It's a technique, it's an efficient way, we think, of running the world economy. And it seems like all these smaller economies in the world are being pulled in to this larger technique. That's an example. Civilizations fall and cannot be reclaimed from the abstract, so we cannot go back to what we were, he suggests. Men and women do not need to know each other to carry out the most important endeavors of our times. Technique has become the bond between men and women. By its agency, they communicate whatever their languages, beliefs, or race. Finally, this is the most contentious dimension of technique, autonomy of technique. Technique is totalitarian. If it is not, it will be. Humans cannot prosper or conceive of life without technique. We have to use technique, but where does it end? Morality judges morality, but technique judges technique. It is neither good nor bad. It does as it will. Efficiency rules. Liberty, choice, individuality are mere appearances. And this gets back to that first quote I had there. Efficiency is a fact, and justice is a slogan. It's kind of a strong statement. Finally, men, and I have to include women here too, are a useless appendage. 10% of all telephone calls are to wrong numbers. So we can't even trust ourselves to dial a telephone or to drive, for example, or to pay our phone bills. There's always a better way that is devised to replace human beings, human actions. To err is human, we think, but technique comes in, the technological system comes in and provides a more efficient way. And the point I want to make with Alul's characterology of technique is that as we align ourselves in society based on efficiency, there are tremendous social costs. If you think about it, if we are to become a very efficient society, think how we have to get every single human being to line up and do things in the most efficient manner. There are tremendous costs, and that's another point I want to bring out here, is that technique leads to progressive dehumanization. So, that was kind of a long explanation of chapter two. Chapter four on growth. I think I'll just say a couple things about that. And it stems from chapter three on efficiency. There are two ways to be more efficient. One is you can produce more from the same amount of inputs, more output from the same amount of inputs. And that's the one that we do now. We seem to want to produce more all the time. The other efficiency is to produce the same amount of outputs with fewer inputs, and we don't choose that one. So it seems like efficiency takes direction, and that direction is of growth. And that's where I lead up to chapter four. Growth becomes the economic imperative. Economists like to use the term monotonic principle, which means that more is preferred to less. And that is sort of ubiquitous in our society. It's everywhere. We don't even think about it. It's just, yeah, I want more. Maybe not here at Holden, but you know, as a society. Let's say, for example, and I think I'll leave chapter four at this. Let's say, for example, the United States economy produces $250 billion worth of goods and services this month, August. Or that's July, right? Okay, July. Let's say our economy produces $250 billion worth in August and in September and October, November, and December. Let's say it produces $250 billion worth of goods and services for 6 months in a row. What condition are we in if that happens? Sounds like it's a recession. Because our economy is so dependent on growth, we can't produce the same amount. We have to continually produce more. So even if we produce that amount, which is a lot, we still are in a recession. And we are dependent on, we all know the costs and the problems that arise with recessions, crime rates, you know, unemployment, there's many, many different problems that arise with that. So we are dependent on growth. So that's where we're at right now. I'm suggesting that the Enlightenment started this process of progress. It has led to the imperative, the technological imperative of efficiency, and the economic imperative of growth. And there's signals out there, or there's signs out there, I'm suggesting, that suggest that this cannot go on. This system of relying on efficiency and growth cannot go on. And there are some examples that I'd like to use in my dissertation, and I'd like to get some feedback from you and ask you if these are good examples, if they really drive home the point. And the first one is on climate change, which is chapter, actually I'm going to switch the order here. Climate change will be chapter four. And I need to draw on the board here. So. This is a poorly drawn map of the world. I was was trying to do it before he came in. But has anybody heard or read about the Atlantic conveyor problem with climate change and what might happen to it? Okay, has anybody else heard about that? Okay, so it'd be worth explaining. Okay. The reason I'm choosing this as an example is that I think it's pretty alarming. And I'm trying to choose case studies in my dissertation that make people step back and go, you know, whoa, something's happening. We can't go on the way we've been going. Well, what Wallace Broker, who's an oceanographer, and he specializes in currents, what he has suggested is that with climate change, we can actually change the direction of ocean currents. And the Atlantic conveyor problem goes as follows. The trade winds come across South America. This is warm air. And it warms up the ocean here, which forms a current that runs up along Europe. By the way, this is South America, that's Africa. This is supposed to be Spain and Norway and Sweden. This is England. So we have this warm water current that goes up into the North Sea. It's fed by the warm trade winds. This current warms up Europe. Europe is about 10 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it would normally be without this current. That's why, for example, Minneapolis is right here, and I think Bordeaux, France, is about at the same latitude. London is way up here. Let's see, Madrid is here, and Chicago is here. But that's why the weather in Minneapolis, which I know intimately, is a lot colder than, let's say, Bordeaux, even up farther north in London. So we have this warm water current that goes up here. Now, as this current flows north and it's warm, it evaporates. And when seawater evaporates, it becomes saltier, more salinity. Now, because you evaporate the water and you leave the salt. So this salty, warm water goes north, and as soon as it hits the cold water in the North Sea, it dives, it sinks. And there are a couple, I believe there are two sink points, one by Iceland, another one by Greenland. And the water, the salty water, warm water, sinks to the bottom of the ocean and returns, goes all the way over to the Indian Ocean. That's the conveyor. And it starts by the warm winds, and it's drawn like a suction pump by the sinks up there.
I think that what you're supposed to be, it's supposed to be the Gulf Stream, and it's coming out of the Caribbean. So it's the track is a little different. It's coming out from over
here.
Yeah, it curves up from there, and no, it curves up the coast of North America and across towards Europe.
Oh, this way.
Yeah, maybe, yeah, something like
well,
that.
Well, we'll have to check anyway, because what I've read, it goes...
It's the Gulf Stream, which people are familiar with. The Gulf Stream carries warm water to Europe and warms it.
All right. Well, let's check on that. I'll debate that one with you. But the point is this. With climate change, if we have this sink up here, what's happening is that a lot of the snow is melting. This is Greenland here, but snow is melting globally. What could happen... some theorists are suggesting is that there could be a big influx of fresh water that will dilute the salty water up here and therefore stop the sink. The only reason it's sinking is because it's really salty water that's being pulled down. So if you have a big influx of fresh water, there won't be that sink anymore. And you could stop this whole current in effect. And then you would decrease the temperature of Europe by 10 degrees. So that the reason I chose that example is because I think it's pretty alarming. Yes.
Hasn't there been some thought about the level of the oceans rising too?
Sure.
As more snow and glaciers or icebergs are melted?
Yeah, there are all kinds of things that are theorized anyway that could happen with climate change. The reason I chose that one is I think it's pretty alarming. And I want people to say, well, okay, you know, we are doing something wrong if we're changing the climate that much. So that is see what chapter. Hello? No? It's in the chair, I guess. There we go. So that's chapter 4, climate change. Now, again, I switched these. The other,
Can you just connect that for us to what you were talking about above, how this
yeah.
I think I will.
Okay. Right at the end here, then I will. And then that's when I'm going to ask you for your feedback. Yes. Chapter 5, then, will be mass extinction. And this one's also pretty alarming. And again, I want people to sit back and step back and say, oh, you know, we need to change. These are mass extinction events that paleobiologists have believe have happened. And there have been six of them in the history of the world, the planet. The Ordovician was 439 million years ago, and they suggest that 85% of marine animals died. Devonian was 367 million years ago, 85% of animal kingdom died. The Permian, 95%. The Triassic, which is the one we're most familiar with, 85% of the animal kingdom, the Cretaceous. And the Holocene, which is the current one, is different in two ways. And this is my point here. First of all, it's quantitatively different because it's the fastest rate ever. And these happen over longer periods than what's happening now. And it's also qualitatively different because it's induced by one species. And I think that's a pretty strong statement saying that we are doing something wrong. And I'm going to link this back to our technological and our economic systems. The other thing I was thinking about doing, which I have not, I'm not ready at this point to talk about too much, I can individually, is social pathology. I think there are a lot of things going on in society that are also strong signals about our technological and our economic systems. There's something I'm interested in is the concept of real virtuality versus virtual reality, real virtuality. And that is where, for example, the Columbine shooting, some people suggest that the kids thought they were actually in an arcade game, you know, where virtual reality or video games become what is real. Sort of a very postmodern idea. Well, I'd like to link something like that back to the technological and the economic imperatives that I've been talking about in the first part. So, what I'd like to do now is combine all these together and then get some feedback from you about how we can change this thing. And to do that, I'd like to use a diagram. And this will be, I think I decided to manage it and use this diagram. But I think it pulls it all together. Now, if any of you had macroeconomics, or principles of macroeconomics. Good. Don't take it.
Don't take it.
This is the diagram. It's called the circular flow diagram. This is the diagram that you would get if you took principles of macroeconomics. And it's a diagram of the economy. Okay? It starts with the household sector. These are consumers and laborers. Us. And it has a business sector. Now, the household sector provides labor to the business sector, and with labor in the business sector, it produces goods and services. There's also another flow. For your labor, coming back this way, you get some wages, right? Some money, and with your wages, you pay for those goods and services. So there's a money flow and a profit flow. Okay, that is the standard economic diagram for the economy. And it suggests that this thing is just, it's like a perpetual motion machine. It just feeds on itself. Okay? But it's omitting some really important things. One is you can't simply go to work and make something. You need more resources. So there's another flow that's often omitted, and that is extraction. And you have to extract resources from somewhere, and then also you need to account for the waste that goes back in to somewhere, but the diagram again does not have that somewhere. So what I'd like to add, what other people have added, is around the economy, you have the environment, or what you can call the biosphere, nature, and into that goes the waste, and from that comes the extraction. And that, I think, is a clearer picture of the economy.
Now, to tie this into what I was talking about, the first part was that we have a system that's dependent on growth. So this economy continually has to get bigger. And we do not want recessions. We do not want to get smaller. So this is the sort of underlying contradiction with this whole technological and economic system we have, is that we have an economic system that's bent on growth, but the biosphere itself does not grow. So you can see what's happening is that eventually this gets so big, or it's getting big enough where it's affecting the biosphere. And what I'm suggesting is that mass extinction and climate change are signals, signs, that we are bumping up against the edges of the biosphere. And that's why it is time to consider something different. And also, we're at an impasse, because some of you may have identified, well, it's not necessarily the size of the economy, it's this flow. It's how much we're extracting and how much waste we're putting back in there. That's the important thing, as far as the environment goes. So why don't we just extract less and produce less waste? Why don't we become more efficient? So this is where I'm trying to tie it back into efficiency. Well, efficiency could be an answer to this problem, but Jocko Lewis suggests that more efficiency leads to more dehumanization. And that's a problem. This is the impasse that we're at. And my thesis at this point is that humanism, which started 500 years ago, started this process that led to the technological and the economic imperative of efficiency and growth. But the answer now, efficiency, leads to more dehumanism. So this is the impasse that we're at, I think. And in a theoretical way, it's sort of a dialectic. This is the thesis, this is the antithesis. What is the synthesis? Or where is the paradigm shift that comes in to change this whole thing? That's where I'm at right now. And I have come up with some alternatives, but I'm not here to tell you about my alternatives. I was wondering if you have felt anything going on in the society, or if you know of any better way of doing this. I think there's a reason why you came to Holden. You care. You have some compassion. You probably felt some of these things. But what is on your mind?
So,
yes.
Are you searching for a paradigm shift?
I don't know yet. When you go into a PhD program, there's that draw between a dialectical and a paradigmatic change. I don't know which one I believe in. Dialectical change means that you have thesis, antithesis, synthesis, where the change is within the structure itself and then it evolves into something else. A paradigm change is where something comes in from the outside and sort of blindsides it and changes it forever. I would rather see a paradigmatic change. I would like to see something come in on the winds and change the technological and economic system, but what that is, I don't know yet.
I know little or nothing about what you're speaking about, but I think it's very interesting. But is there ever a possibility of reaching a point of equilibrium? You speak in saying that everything has to continue to grow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is there a point where we could reach equilibrium and things will be balanced and we didn't have to continue to grow?
That's the contradiction in our economic system, is that if we don't grow, we have a recession, and we all know what a recession does. You know, we don't. There are tremendous costs with recessions.
Why do we have to have a recession, though, based on growth?
Well, I think that is the question about our system, is that it is so bent on the growth paradigm and the underlying logic of growth that it won't operate the way it's supposed to without it. And that, I mean, when you ask that question, what you're really suggesting is we need a different system. And, you know,
steady state economy.
Steady state economy, maybe. That's a good point.
How societal is this model? Is this North American? Does it operate in China or Russia or Brazil like it does here?
China is becoming more market-oriented. Yeah, I would say this is more the capitalistic market. economies.
Because of the IMF and World Bank and things like that, this model is being promoted in other places.
Sure, sure. If you look at WDP, World Domestic Product, it's booming. It's on a growth trend. Some of you may have, for example, stocks in other countries. They're growing. A lot of that is not directly, but a lot of that is related to the growth of those economies. And that, I hate to say it, but the United States is very concerned about the growth of other countries, especially when it comes to, say, climate change. The United States' official position is that we need to get the third world countries in on this climate change convention because they, especially China and India, they will start growing and they will just ruin whatever we're trying to do with the climate change. It's not really fair because we, the industrialized countries, are the ones that caused climate change in the first place. So there's some issues there.
I wouldn't expect any changes as it is now until it's profitable for business to do otherwise. You'll just have to get to a state where businesses will look for the change.
So people have, actually the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is promoting that. They have a program called P2, Pollution Prevention. And its basis is, again, efficiency. Is if you identify waste in any of your production process, let's say you produce cars, and you find out that there's a lot of waste in producing the carburetor or the tires. If you eliminate that waste, your whole production process will be more efficient. But my point here, again, is that is based on efficiency. And efficiency, the way that Jocko Lewis describes it, is progressive dehumanization. So
efficiency just means that you can pump up the accelerator a bit and go faster. You're more efficient. You can extract more, mm-hmm. You just do it more efficiently.
Right, but what he was saying is that with that, when we align ourselves and become more efficient, there are social costs that come along with that. And that's the impasse that I'm arguing.
Isn't it really a problem with growth, though? That you couldn't disconnect efficiency with growth? That it always had to be, you know, same input, more output, versus less input, same output?
Same output.
So I don't think it's really efficiency that's the problem. It sounds like it's growth.
It sounds like the direction of efficiency.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, to Lua, it would be any efficiency is a problem, but.
But wasn't it because it had to go toward the growth?
No.
Oh.
No. It was just organizing yourselves in a better way. We all do it. I mean, he's not saying that all that is bad, because we all do that. Look at this room. You know, it's organized in rows, sort of. That's sort of a technique. But what he's suggesting is that the technique process has taken over. And the only way it can go on from here is more dehumanization. So that I think is the impasse that we're at.
Yeah, I mean, what he's saying makes sense, but it doesn't, you know, it could be a self-fulfilling prophecy too, because, I mean, does this mean human beings can't control this? Are we just gonna sort of posit that this technique controls us and just sort of give up? I mean, that's basically what a lot of economists, you know, Bill Gates has to say, well, in the future, you will do this, you will do this. I don't think that's true. I think we can make choices, mm-hmm. You know. I think that's what being human is about, and I don't buy that.
Can I just respond to that? Have you read the book?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, but I read it, I think at Harper's, it says he uses the phrase, you will, 57 times in the book.
Huh. Well, if you read the book, the last sentence says that if you read the book, you get the impression that there is no way out. It's autonomous.
There's no way?
It's autonomous. There's no way out. This
exactly.
Is just happening. But the last sentence says something to the effect that these are the problems that the conscious have to contemplate. Okay. So what he's saying is that if we are awake, if we can see what's happening, then maybe we can do something about it. And by the way, he was a theologian.
What?
Jocko Lewis was a theologian, so I think he had some influence there too.
That's okay.
Oh, it looks to me like you're trying to tap into other sources of wisdom over here. Mm-hmm. And it just occurred to me that you might want to consider sort of women's wisdom or women's way of doing things, since most of this was created in times when women weren't part of the process, really. Mm-hmm. And I just wrote down a few things that popped into my mind that might be more a women's way of doing things. Working in a circle rather than hierarchy, with nature instead of against nature, in the body as well as the mind, relationship, not achievement, storytelling, not analysis, interconnectedness and adaptation rather than competition and control, and nurture rather than product. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, just for your consideration, that might be another.
Yeah, that I think that's very good. I'm very open to that. In fact, I really like Vandana Shiva. I don't know if you know about her work, but her model is of regeneration instead of growth. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of a sustainable development, but not quite. It tries to get all the paternal stuff out of there. Mm-hmm. The regeneration is what we really need to concentrate on in an economy. But my question still is, with this system we have, how do we regenerate when we're bent on growth? And I think you're right, growth is a tremendous problem.
What's the prospect that this might be a self-correcting problem? And the example I would use is that we all get, and I suspect we all get frustrated by having a computer answer a phone somewhere and trying to get through. Yeah. In the state I live in Oregon, there's a number of new small businesses, banks is the industry I've read about, that are junking their automatic answering systems and putting people back in. The people that go there to bank pay a little more because of that service, and that's a trade they're willing to make. Mm-hmm. Might we get to the point where that occurs on a larger scale?
I hope so.
We pay more consciously.
Yeah.
For a more human system.
Yeah. I hope so. I think that is an option that I could consider. In fact, that's what Alu is suggesting, is that if we're conscious, you know, we will change it ourselves.
Yeah.
I think we can adopt technology that is more humanistic. E.F. Schumacher talked about that, you know, technology with a human face. I think there's some ideas in there. In fact, I was going to talk about E.F. Schumacher here, but I can't talk about everything. But he has a model, Buddhist economics, which is entirely different. And I still am not convinced that we can get away from the growth idea without... I want to. I'm not suggesting that, but I don't know if we can get away from the growth model without the whole economic system collapsing. If we make, for example, humans answering the phone, like you're suggesting, if we make that more profitable or efficient for companies, I think that is a good idea. I think that might be a good direction.
I think that's one of the issues, though, is that when we look at efficiency, more often than not, we're looking at how do we more efficiently produce things as opposed to improve our quality of life. And I think our quality of life is dependent on so many other things that it's interconnected, and I think that's what you get about with the biosphere. And I think we need to redefine what efficiency is, because I don't see us not to debate Delulio, but I mean, I don't see us not being more efficient. And growth is always going to be here. I mean, we're always going to try and push our boundaries as a race, as being human. I think that's probably what it is. Mm-hmm. And I think we just need to expand the circle and the definition of what it really means to be human and what it means to be efficient.
So how would I adopt that in this diagram here?
I It's a good question. That's why you're writing a dissertation on that.
What's the matter about a recession? You know, it seems to me the bad thing about a recession is the distribution system. Japan right now has been in recession for years. Mm-hmm. I talk to Japanese all the time. They've got to have enough money to come here and go to school, you know. So it may not, it's more of a question in this country. I think recession would particularly be hurting poor people because our distribution system is out of whack.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But if you adjust to the distribution system, so what? Mm-hmm. Maybe it would be okay.
Yeah, that's...
I mean, of course, all the newspapers would say it's a disaster, but everybody can go about their business and they're eating and sleeping and living.
But how many people then really feel that they have a sense of relevance in their life?
How many people what?
Really feel that they have a sense of relevance in their life.
Sense of relevance in life?
Yeah.
Well, that's a big question.
I think of like Holden, and I think
I mean, a lot of people in a...
Holden's an amazing community. But you take a lot of people here, and I work here, I'm a volunteer staff. I work 6 hours a day, 6 days a week. I have lots of free time. I think there are a lot of people who don't particularly like having free time.
Oh, I absolutely agree. This is a complete change of subject. I mean, I was talking about an economic sense, but we could talk about the same thing just because the economy is functioning well doesn't mean people are satisfied with it, even when it's functioning extremely quickly.
But they have something to do.
They have something to do.
And that's an economic thing.
That's true.
And I think you need to give people something to do, otherwise you have to give them relevance and you have to give them a point.
I think that's true.
And I think
that if people are motivated strictly by material gain,
right.
then people need to grow, and if they're not growing in other ways, they're going
to
try and grow materially.
Right.
So you've got everybody tied into this drug, which is economic growth, which is what gives people their motivation
right.
and reason they get up in the morning, and they've lost track of any other reason for being alive. If they had other goals, then the economic goals would be as important.
I think that's the big issue.
You could promote spiritual growth instead.
That,
you know, concentrate on that instead of material growth.
Mm-hmm. No bottom line. I say there's no bottom line for the people that
don't paradigm shift.
Jeremy Rifkin has written a book recently called The End of Work. And in that, he suggests in the next 100 years, only 20% of the labor force will be working. I was talking about work. And he addresses the rest of the book about what the other 80% are going to do. And spirituality is one, volunteering is another one.
Is he talking about Western world?
Yeah. He's suggesting it's here. But his thesis is based on the sufficiency idea, that we become so efficient that only 20% of the labor force has to work to produce everything for the rest. Now, I'm not suggesting that as an imperative.
That was brought up a long time ago with all the labor-saving devices.
Yes.
In, you know, the 20s, all these labor-saving devices, time-saving devices, but it just meant that you had more time to work harder.
Well, I think that's true of most technology. I mean, Americans are working more today than they ever have. And we are working more than any other country as well.
I
mean, France legally...
Yeah, Europeans are...
France legally reduced their work week to like 32 hours. And yeah, the Japanese, I think, are glaring.
And most Europeans have long vacations compared to ours.
That's a different model. I mean, this is a European country.
Right.
Well, they have a better distribution, too. Their economic system has a better distribution, wider distribution.
You know, they have a higher suicide rate, a lot of trade-offs.
Who has the higher suicide
rate? The Japanese.
And
much higher.
Is your work based on the presumption that the capitalist free market system will pervade the everything? That wouldn't shift necessarily to a more socialist
The trend now is no. I think.
Would that make much of a change?
Yeah, well, actually, that's... I should have said that.
The dominant paradigm right now is that the biosphere isn't out here at all. It's brought into the economic system as environment, and it's become sort of this macro management thing that we are now going to use our technology to manage. It's not only in the environment scale, it's also on the molecular scale with biotechnology. Everything is pulled into the economic system to be managed. But again, I can't get past my dehumanization impasse, is that if that happens, it's progressive dehumanization, and I'm not accepting that. And that's why I'm looking for something so fundamentally different. I don't know where it is. I thought theologians might help me, and some have, actually. Jerry, see here, he might have left already. He has suggested some reading to me, and this is a good book by Thomas Berry, The Dream of the Earth. Sorry.
Yeah, two things, I mean, one, I think that you've really caricatured the Enlightenment in one, that it's such a big span to begin with, but if we think about the crises that precipitated the Enlightenment, the kind of crises of authority within the church coming out of the Reformation, and so there's a whole questioning there of authority with different, you know, the Roman Catholics saying they are the church and the authority, and the Lutherans and the Germans saying they're the authority, and Calvin and company. So there's that crisis there, so where does one turn to? Descartes and company would say, well, let's turn to reason, because there we can get a method, and reason becomes a method of getting at truth rather than just simply listening to the authorities who have just been fighting one another and killing one another off in Europe for 30 years, so we need some other kind of authority. Mm-hmm. That's the one crisis. The other crisis is that the humanism, dehumanization, understand, is the Enlightenment sees a kind of dehumanizing influence coming out of the late medieval era, because it's the opening up of the world, and there's an understanding now of the infinite. And the problem is, when you have an understanding and a beginning now of a kind of infinite universe, infinite understandings of time, and where does one find the center in infinity? That's kind of a difficult problem. Mm-hmm. And so where one looks to try to find the center, and again, whether that's Descartes or Hobbes or, you know, different thinkers, they're going to try to find the center in what they understand, what distinguishes the human being from all other created beings, and what links them up to what they thought is the image of God, and that's the notion of reason. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to try to be reasonable, because that's the best way of being human. Mm-hmm. All right, so they go on. We'll stop with that. I mean, I think the difficulty comes when, in later eras, and I mean, again, you can read people like Jürgen Habermas or whatever, and in doing that, is that the whole thing is that reason becomes reduced to simply a kind of calculative reason, because that kind of reason seemed to be the way that easily solves problems, and therefore you have a notion of efficiency. Mm-hmm. But even there, with efficiency, and I think particularly by the end of the 19th century, certainly into the 20th century, and where we're at now, even efficiency is no longer the highest value, it's profitability. Mm-hmm. That, for example, General Motors is not interested in how they can best efficiently produce a car. General Motors is interested in how best to utilize their capital for profitability in order to pay the best dividends to their investors. And at least, as I've looked at some of this stuff, big companies, Fortune 500 companies, the blue chippers, GM, General Electric, and all of that, most of their profits have been made in the last 3 years in playing the big capital speculation and you know, global casino roulette. It's not by, you know, making cars or electrical products or whatever. It's the speculative market. And playing that is where it's at. Profitability has become the value, not even efficiency. And so there again, there's another shift. And therefore, I think, a sense of dehumanization, because a company could be going well, But, you know, if for the third quarter, while it was projected that maybe they would be returning 92 cents, on the, you know, the dividend is down to only 84 cents. Well, gee, that's going to really look bad. So what do we have to do? Well, we have to lay off 3,000 people. Not because they haven't been productive, not because they're not efficient, but we've got to make the books look right to keep the investors happy. Now, that's a whole other game than what happened, let's say, in beginning Enlightenment thinking and reason and the great heroes of rational thinking, whether that be Descartes or Locke or down to the end of the Enlightenment, someone like Kant. They, too, I think, would be appalled at how irrational thinking about doing things in terms of profitability is, because really to look at profitability is not a particularly rational enterprise, and maybe that's the way to go, to expose the irrationality of a supposedly rational techno/economic system.
And short-term profit lots of times.
Well, short-term, exactly.
Not even long-term.
See, I would replace profitability with the word shareholder value. Because the guys in the highest levels of management are personally rewarded on shareholder value. And the company can be really profitable, but it has to be in that dividend going back to the shareholders.
Mm-hmm. So you're suggesting it's an issue of power at the top.
Well, the companies I've worked with, I've seen the largest chemical company in the world, Ciba-Geigy, merge with Sandoz. And Ciba-Geigy was a terrific company for the people who worked for it. And when it merged with Sandoz, the whole place just got torn up and morale went bad. People committed suicide. And now they're just, watching whatever the Swiss shareholders say. And the best people are gone, and greatest ideas are just languishing.
How different do you think profitability or shareholder value is from my economic imperative of growth? I understand the point about it being different than efficiency. But how different is that from economic growth, having that being a social imperative?
Well, because again, it gives a particular understanding and nuance to what we mean about growth. Let's say the most optimistic time of the Enlightenment, end of the 18th century, and that where there was a notion of growth in terms of the growth of the human being in terms of reason. I'll give two in. I mean, there's the old cliche there, the little phrase that, you know, every day in some way we're getting better and better. You know, now that's growth, but that's not saying, you know, I'm getting richer and richer. Or the notion of growth and the kind of optimism Alexander Pope, right, in one of his little poems would say, nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light. Now, there you go, right? Now, that's a tremendous sense of optimism, but it's optimism in that the kind of human capacity that is exemplified in a genius like Newton will enable us to all grow into being better human beings, because we can now understand, or it also had that negative sense to it, conquer, control our world. But that's a very different kind of growth than, let's say, the profit or shareholder dividends we're talking about now. I mean, for folks now, you know, Newton would probably be a liability if he were working for R&D.
Yeah, I'd agree. Newton uncovered the balance in nature, but we have misapplied Newtonian principles to conquering.
And I mean, I think in that sense, Newton, even within his own era, is held up as that kind of paradigm or paragon of what enlightenment was all about.
Well, this is great. This is exactly what I need.
Have you ever heard of a book called Eclipse of Reason by Horkheimer? Which is, you might know of him. He is associated with Frankfurt School and Habermas. But that book is called A Critique of Instrumental Reason, in which he makes exactly this dichotomy between a reason, which is really for the benefit of human beings, and a reason which has sort of gone off on its own and is now telling human beings how to behave. And they also, he wrote a book with Adorno, another guy, called The Dialectic of Enlightenment, which talks about the same issue.
See, this, let me just comment on that. This is what I'm looking for, because I want to tie it back into, even though I may be caricature. I'm making a caricature of the Enlightenment. I want to pull it back to that.
It's often done this.
I would like to somehow tie it together. I don't want to do that, but I would like to make it a package. You know, come back to the beginning.
I think the Enlightenment, like he was saying, I think it was one of the bright moments. I think as it sounds, it was a very bright moment, an optimistic moment, coming out of a very dark period. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been misused and abused greatly.
All right, I do not want to suggest that.
It sounds like the same thing that has happened with reason, that you mentioned, that at first reason was a tool for us, and then it became something that drove us. It's the same thing that happened here with growth and, to a certain extent, efficiency. Probably initially those were tools, or you know, when they first started becoming more part of our societal ideals, they were tools to improve our human condition. However, now they've become the end goal, the growth, the profit, whatever you want to call it, and efficiency, and we need maybe to get back to just using them as tools and having our end goal be improved humanization.
That was originally their intention, and it's misguided.
Yeah, so maybe
gone off track. But you know,
what we want is to get back to that.
Yeah.
So what we have is a misguided enlightenment in the latter period,
right.
The current period.
Right. Such that our tools have become our.
You don't reject something. You have to take what you got and use it properly. You don't, you know, sort of throw it out and start over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems to me you go on. You say, well, we went off a little bit too far here. Let's get back on course.
What happens in this model when people no longer have the means to consume at the rate that they consume now?
That's a great point. I was just talking to a friend the other day. It seems to me that people in the United States are running out of time to spend their money. I mean, we're working so much. I mean, you don't want to go to the mall. We're supposed to go to the mall on the weekends, on Saturday and Sunday, right? But some people simply do not have the time to do that. And how many more television sets can you have in your house?
That's why we've invented new technology to shop, the internet.
Yeah, the internet. I'm supposed to sell
it. I think there's a lot of people who no longer have the money either. You know, you continuously hear about the shrinking middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And the poor getting poorer. And eventually, you're no longer going to get a free credit card every Saturday in the month.
Well, our economic system also, this is more of a liberal standpoint, needs the poor to buy their products. The rich need the poor to buy their products. That's another thing. But yeah, I think the inequality of income is definitely a problem. And it seems like a lot of the economies that are faltering right now have a huge disparity between the rich and poor. And that's historical. That's happened.
The irony of huge disparities is they end up killing themselves. Because,
right.
As you say, the poor
the poor don't, if the poor can't buy it, doesn't matter how many refrigerators you make.
That's right. Nancy.
The gap between the rich and the poor is getting much greater, and the poor people are struggling, sometimes putting together 2 and 3 minimum wage jobs, and they haven't got time to go shopping. They're, you know, a kid falls and chips a tooth, causing a dental visit. Mm-hmm. There goes, you know, the month's rent. Now, oh my God, what are we going to do? Leads to despair. Greed and power, I think, are so great. And we're seeing more and more poor people who can't afford to buy the shoes for the kids. This, in the schools, you know, the school districts are now saying that the kids must supply the paper, they must supply the pencils, you know, this kind of thing. And this is enough to push people right straight over the edge. Mm-hmm. And then we see violence and alcohol abuse, drug abuse, all these kinds of things come into play.
And I think the next recession, and it's probably inevitable that we will have one, at least that's been our history, is really going to affect the poor a lot, and even middle class, because they're so heavily indebted. When they call in the credit cards that you were talking about.
Another factor in this, of course, is regulation, law, rule, and that sort of thing. You swing between being what you think is overregulated and maybe underregulated. And I'm not a political science, but my sense of it is that those are the accelerators and the brakes on the whole system. Things start to get a little out of balance. The government changes the regulations, the subsidies or restrictions or tariffs or whatever they are. Mm-hmm. Is it within our both the power and level of acceptance of regulations that the system could be, over a period of time, moved back into a humanist?
You've regulated for a humanist?
It's a trade again. Trade some freedoms for more human society.
I think what you're, I mean, you're not, I don't think you're going quite that far, but I think what you're suggesting is a sort of a reemergence of socialism, which supposedly had those goals too.
Yeah, the thing that strikes me in watching the mega mergers and all that sort of thing is that when the government, us, give up regulation, it doesn't mean the rules go away, it only means the rules are made by a different set of people.
Exactly.
And so the rules are always there, and what we're moving to is a set of a place where the rules are now made in boardrooms and not in public hearings, mm-hmm. or something like that.
I guess, I mean, I agree with that. I'm a liberal all the way through, but my question for my dissertation would be, would socialism change this basic contradiction? We'd have to do socialism, we'd have to do away the market system altogether, I think, or capitalism
altogether. We've got a mixed economy, that's just, we already have a mixed economy.
Yeah, we do have a mixed
economy.
It's already
partly social, and I think we're always going to have a balance, and maybe we need more socialism now. Yeah. It doesn't mean it has to be the same as it was before or something, but I think the idea that government is always bad is preposterous. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons this country is the way it is because we've had fairly successful government.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to find out what people in Sweden or France or somewhere think about their how human their systems, societies are compared to ours.
Yeah, I agree with that, but still, market socialism still depends on growth. And that's what I'm trying to get away from. That's the contradiction.
I think it's less dependent on that. I mean, as I was saying, I mean, of course all the press says this is a disaster, but if a country like Sweden has a recession, nobody starves. I mean, so what if they call it whatever you want? Life goes on.
Everybody's eating.
I mean, of course the press is going to make a big thing about it. There's going to be a lot of people that are going to be screaming because they're not making as much bucks as they were before.
I think that the next session is supposed to start. Oh, hi.
Oh, sorry. It's 5? What time was it supposed to get over? 4:45. Okay, well, if I'll be here for another couple weeks if you want to stop me. I'll be away, try. I'd be happy to take a break.
Yeah.
And thank you very much for your attention and also your feedback.
Thank you.
It's been very helpful. Thank you.